Good evening, everyone. And I should probably apologize for sitting here in my office this evening, whereas I should probably be delivering this message from the pulpit at the hall. And I've experienced some difficulty with my trusty old laptop, which was doing just fine up in 18 months ago. I shut it off during COVID, never did anything for 18 months. And when I turned it back on, it just didn't work. And, you know, after 18 months of doing nothing, I guess it just couldn't handle it. So I didn't have the laptop to come down with, but Brother Jeremy, he kindly offered me the use of his laptop. And I'm quite comfortable using his laptop because he reminded me and assured me he pays for his software. However, I'm quite uncomfortable using other folks' equipment. You know, what if his failed partway through the presentation? Who knows? Well, certainly his days would be numbered. But that's really the universal problem we all have, the fact that we have a short period of time and our days are numbered. And our account tonight begins in Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, the first great world empire. It was depicted in prophecy as the head of gold in the vision of the nations, the first great empire in the table of nations, considered to have the most concentrated power in the list of all that were to come. It was totalitarian. It was ruled by Nebuchadnezzar. So we find ourselves in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, 597 BC, maybe 600 BC. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family, the nobility, youth without blemish, good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature of the Chaldeans. So with Nebuchadnezzar's first raid of Jerusalem, he carried off some precious things, including some gold and precious vessels from the house of God in Jerusalem. But also he kind of cherry picked all the higher educated folks, especially the young men who had been trained in the ways of Judaism and in the ways of Jerusalem, because they obviously would be helpful in the transition of these peoples to King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, when they were presented to the king, or were being presented to the king, Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food with the wine or with the wine that he drank. And this was a fairly bold thing for Daniel and his companions, his three companions, to do, to kind of, in a way, defy the most powerful king that had ever lived, who had just brought them captive, slave, to Jerusalem. Daniel said to the steward and the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Test your servants 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat at the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see." So he listened to them, and in this matter he tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away food, the food and the wine that they were to drink, and gave them vegetables. So these four young men, captives from Babylon, were to become legendary in Babylon. As these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. The king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king, And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Now, what this is telling us, that Daniel had a tenure of about 75 years between the house of Nebuchadnezzar and the house of Cyrus, king of Babylon. So he was legendary, as were his friends, and they were there until the year of Cyrus, the king of Persia. So just to give a little outline of what was going on here, you had Nebuchadnezzar, who took captive the city of Jerusalem and finally carried the whole city away and destroyed it, carried everything away that was, such as stones that were left behind, about 590 BC. He reigned for about 40 years. His son, Nabonidus, took over the kingdom and the throne after him. And Belshazzar, who was considered to be a co-regent, he might have been Nabonidus' son. He may have been Nebuchadnezzar's son. The records are fairly sketchy. And, of course, we have these records in the book of Daniel. The empire of Nabonidus went way east. And Babylonian records tell us that he kind of left the main center of the kingdom in Babylon and moved east with conquests. And he was away from the empire for 10 or 15 years. And Belshazzar was kind of ruling there as a co-regent. Now, Belshazzar, I think we would say it was probably a piece of work. He liked to party. And so instead of ruling this kingdom that his grandfather had established, strongest kingdom that had ever been on the earth, he was hanging out with feasts. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. And Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, and I guess this is a warning to us that sometimes we can get into too much wine and we start doing things that aren't very smart. And what he did was he commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought. And the kings and his lords and his wives and his concubines drank from them, which was a very stupid thing to do. It was as if, and I'm sure this is true, as if Belshazzar had failed history 101. The whole history of Nebuchadnezzar, he seemed to have no memory. This region in Babylon, crumbling empire as it was, his days numbered, he crossed the line. Wine clouded his judgment. They brought the vessels in and they drank and praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. Now this I suppose is something similar to sort of thumbing your nose at God, at the Most High. Certainly it was disrespect, and it was probably more than disrespect. It was probably a rude gesture to be drinking wine out of these holy things from the temple. Now, I'm going to say mocking contempt. This says to God, these rulers, you are nothing. The folks at the party are in control of everything. We're God, the folks at the party. This was a huge problem. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's father or grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, had learned the truth about the God of Israel when he was exiled for his pride and his arrogance. Daniel 4:24-25, you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whom he will. Belshazzar, as I said, had to fail history badly. Don't mock the Most High was a fundamental thing he should have known. The Most High still rules. So here he is in the middle of his party, And immediately, as he's drinking this wine in the cups and utensils from the temple in Jerusalem, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. The king's color changed and his thoughts alarmed him. And his limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. And in his panic, he loudly calls to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, the astrologers, and I added psychics, soothsayers, mediums, and witches, to come and help him sort this thing out. He was absolutely freaked out. And the king declared to these wise men, quote unquote wise men from Babylon, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Daniel 5, verse 5 to 10. Shall be the third ruler in the kingdom, which proves that the Bible is right on with its historical facts, because the ruler in the kingdom at that time was Nabonidus first, Belshazzar second. So the third ruler was the only one position left. You shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. And all the king's wise men came in and they could not read the writing or make it known to the king, its interpretation. And King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His color changed and his lords were perplexed. Now again, as I said, he clearly didn't do well in history, but evidently the queen did. The queen, again, probably past history 101, because of the words of the king and his lords and what she heard, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, made him chief of the musicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems was found in this Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation of this dream. And just as a passing thought here, it's amazing that these times of great change, when empires come and go, the leaders very often demonstrate an amazing lack of historical understanding and an amazing lack of good common sense. Daniel was brought in before the king. And the king answered and said to Daniel, you are that Daniel, and so on. And if you interpret this dream for me, and then I will put a gold ring around your neck and I will make you a third ruler in the kingdom. And Daniel wasn't really interested in that, of course. Daniel answered and said, let your gifts be for yourself. And give your rewards to another. Daniel had no need for gold chains or being third ruler in the kingdom. Nevertheless, I will read the writings of the king and make known to him the interpretation. At this point, you know, in thinking it through, I asked myself, why didn't Daniel attribute the interpretation of this dream or this vision to the Most High God? Why didn't he come in and say, yeah, by the way, I did talk to Nebuchadnezzar and we had a couple of visions and dreams, and the Most High revealed that to me, and so on. Why didn't Daniel do that? Well, here's a thought. Because the words that were on the wall were profoundly simple words. And there should not have been a ruler or a Chaldean who didn't understand these basic words, because they were rooted in Hebrew and Aramaic, but none of them could. And here's what they were. Mene, many, tickle, farson. Three words, actually, because the first two are repeated. Now, Daniel takes these three words and turns them into nouns and verbs. You'll see money means money, number, as if you're numbering, counting money. Twice, money, number, counting. Tickle means weight, weighed. Or by implication, when you weigh, you find out that you're wanting because the scales don't balance. You're short. And Parson is basically Persian, but it means in Hebrew, Perez, divide. Money, money, numbered, numbered, weighed, divided, turned over to the Persians. The amazing thing here is that while they're having this party, the Median army were outside the door. It's amazing that the intelligent network of Belshazzar had failed completely. They were unaware how these three words could simply mean that the kingdom was over. It was done. Daniel 5, 24 to 28. And from his presence, the hand was sent. And this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed. Mene, mene, tikal, farsin. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Numbered, tekel, weighed in the balance. Found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldees, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. We delve into this a little bit more. We find out that, according to some writers, that the Hebrew equivalent of numbers of these three words, many, many, tickle, and farson, add up to 62, which might be something that's of passing interest. But there was a regime change that night. The world changed that night. Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a gold chain around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him being the third ruler of the kingdom. That made any difference to Daniel at all, because the kingdom was over. Persian army under King Darius entered the city of Babylon, killed Belshazzar the king, and Babylon became the kingdom of Persia, not destroyed in one night, just occupied in one night. The only blood that was shed seemed to be this joker Belshazzar. And it must make us wonder, when we think about this, it does me anyway, why we don't see or understand the simple message that's written on our walls and of our lives. The simple message is all around us, talking to us about what's coming and what's going to happen. Our days are numbered. The message surrounds us all. However, this serves to illustrate the universal, eternal, death-dealing, shocking lack of self-awareness that afflicts all of us. From Belshazzar down to me, I don't know about you, but I suspect it's true. This is a frightening problem, because we are about to witness the ultimate regime change. It also serves to remind us that God is in control of the Most High rules in the kingdoms and empires of men and gives them to whoever he chooses. So here's Jesus about the ultimate regime change. There will be signs in the sun and the moon and the stars and on the earth distress of nations and perplexity because of the roaring of the sea and the waves, people fainting with fear and foreboding, for it's coming on the world. One thing we have to admit to here is that there's never been a time in the world, simply because of the sheer number of people, 7.5 billion people on the face of the earth, that these words are so poignant. For the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And that's Jesus's language for the world. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now, when you see these things begin to take place, straighten up and raise your head because your redemption is drawing near. And this is what words, these are the words that Belshazzar, the king, really needed to understand. And these are the words that we need to understand. History repeats itself. Powerful empires wax and wane. They rise and fall. Amazingly, they normally raise up based on clear-headed, energetic, conservative, disciplined, war-footed policies. They fall during liberal, fuzzy-headed immorality, physical weakness, and rejection of God. There will be a final regime change. The Bible warns us all of changes that will alert us, changes in the world that will alert us to the regime change that is to come. Ultimately, we should be looking carefully at the emerging totalitarian world that is quickly closing around us, a world like the world Daniel lived in, that will dictate all the aspects of life, our private, personal communications, even spying on our lives and our moments of prayer. A world that is quickly overtaking us, has been actually changing us inexorably over the past 25 years, and we really haven't been paying attention, I don't think. We live in a world today that doesn't like Christians. We live in a world today that doesn't like Bibles or worship services or any contrary opinion to their prevailing worldview. They hate us because we believe in the miracle of God in creation. They hate us because we believe in a binary biblical worldview that is founded on male and female. They don't believe that. But now they have crossed the line. Clearly regarding creation itself, challenging the basic facts of creation and the life-founding principles of Almighty God, God Most High. We create according to our imagination, says the world, according to our feelings. We don't need a God to tell us about anything. We are God. The world today has gone far beyond having a party and mocking God with the utensils from the Jerusalem temple. As we watch this dissolution, we all know that it won't end well, even while we immerse ourselves in its seduction. But what happened to Daniel? And there must be lessons for us in relation to Daniel. And let's briefly run through the next events in Daniel's life. Daniel went through a regime change. It pleased Darius to set up over the kingdom, 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom. These were high officials of whom Daniel was to be basically the senior official to make sure that the king wouldn't suffer loss. So you can see the great faith that the new king Darius had in Daniel, who was a man of truth and could be relied upon. And Daniel became distinguished above all the other high officials and satraps, because an excellent spirit was in him, exactly as the queen had said. And the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. And we have to understand that some problems are coming because they hated Daniel. They hated Daniel because he represented a miracle. And a lot of these guys were people that were there with Daniel before. The miracle that Daniel believed was the fact and the reality of the Almighty God. The guys in the swamp, of course, immediately conspired to take him down. He was an existential threat. An existential threat is a threat to something's very existence. When the continued well-being of something is at stake or in danger, that's an existential threat. The soothsayers, the warlocks, the satraps, they would have to give account to Daniel, a man of God. Yes, they hated him. Daniel spoke the truth. They spoke lies. And without really saying, by the way, because it's very important that we speak truth. Whatever happens in the world in which we're living, as it deteriorates around us, we must speak truth. That is what Daniel shows us, even while the world around us is speaking lies. So now we have a palace coup going on. This was like the office intrigue at the water cooler, but on steroids. These high officials and satraps sought to find ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. He had a huge, enormous power and authority and responsibility, but they could find no ground for complaint of any fault because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, well, we shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. So now you see they could weaponize the law. If they found no way to do it in any other way, they would weaponize Daniel's law against him. They could make Daniel illegal. So they made a new law. And I think we need to know, friends, that they can come after us just like they came after Daniel. So these high officials and satraps came by agreement. This is a conspiracy, okay? It's a conspiracy to the king and said to them, oh, King Darius, live forever. All the high officials of the kingdom, the prefects, the satraps, the counselors, the governors, are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Shall be cast in the den of lions. They make a new law with teeth in it. Pardon the pun. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document and the injunction. A conspiracy, weaponizing the law, nothing new here. And Daniel, of course, heard fairly quickly about it. And when Daniel heard that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had open windows in his upper chamber. And he got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he had done previously. Law, the decree, didn't change Daniel's habits at all. And somehow or another, I think we're going to have to get around this in our own lives, is that the laws and rules of the world, the government around us that may be designed to take us down, we have to stand. Sorry, we need to be on our knees about this. But our hope is Daniel's in Jerusalem. That's the hope of the world. And that's where he was. And the men made an agreement and found Daniel petitioning and pleading before his God. They put him under surveillance. They surveilled him to get the information they needed. And they came near and said before the king concerning the injunction, O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition of any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? And the king had to agree, of course, that he did. The thing stands fast, he said, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, it cannot be revoked. Then they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, so right away they put him down, right? He's just a Jew from Jerusalem, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed. But he makes his petitions and prayers continues three times a day. Of course, when the king heard these words, he was distressed, we're told. He set his mind to try and deliver his trusted servant, Daniel. And we're told that he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Then the men finally came with the agreement at the end of the day and said to the king, now it's the law. We have to sign this off. And the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the lion's den. And the king said to Daniel, as he was going through the trap door, may your God whom you serve continually deliver you. That's the hope that we all have when we face what's coming. The stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet, the signet of his lords, that nothing might be changed. And the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions, were told in the ESV, which meant nobody call, please, no calls. And sleep fled from him. He couldn't sleep all night, pacing the floor, And at the break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish, and the king declared to Daniel, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him, and also before you, O king. I have done no harm." It's kind of not like Daniel in the lion's den. It's like the lions in Daniel's den with the angel of the Lord. They were completely docile and passive. And the angel with them standing there. And the king was exceeding glad when he called up to Daniel and commanded the den to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no harm at all was found on Daniel because he trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. Well, what can we learn, really, about Daniel's life-saving habits? Let's do a quick review of some of the things that Daniel was doing with his life that made him this honorable, faithful, truthful man of God. And if we look at that and see some instruction, it should help us as we face what is coming on us today. Daniel was a reader. We find this in Daniel chapter 12, verse 1 to 2. Not only was a reader, but he read books on prophecy about the future of his own nation, Israel, and when they would return to Jerusalem to reestablish the kingdom of God. So Daniel was a reader. And I think we just have to say that most of the people of God had access to some form of reading from Moses forward, for sure. And that reading is redemptive. Not Googling or tweeting or YouTubing, but reading. Yes, reading is redemptive. Daniel was a reader. Daniel was a prayer. He prayed. And when he prayed with his face toward the Lord God to make requests by prayer and supplication with sackcloth and fasting and ashes. And he prayed to the Lord. So this was the main thing of Daniel's life, was praying. Daniel prayed, as we know, three times a day. And praying is personal. Praying is engaging with our Creator. Praying focuses our worship. Praying focuses our life. But praying also involves confessing. When we go back to Daniel chapter 9, verse 5, we might say, well, if we're praying, why would we have to be confessing? Well, the dialogue, yes, the dialogue between us and our Creator, the Lord God of heaven, God Most High, we have this dialogue, and confession is part of the self-awareness. Confession highlights self-awareness. It's not that God doesn't know what we're all about, but it's that we are prepared to go before God and express it in our hearts and in our words to create that self-awareness. Amazing. I've already said this, but look, I'm going to say it again. Amazing just how many folks in our society have little or no self-awareness. Prayer creates self-awareness, keeping us talking to the Most High what is going on around us and in our lives. Petitioning. Now, in petitioning, it's asking God for things. And look at this in Daniel chapter 9, verse 17 to 19. O my God, incline your ear and hear. Open your eyes and see our desolations. Daniel went to God and said, please look, please hear. This is a petition. And the Lord needs to know that in our prayers, seeking God's awareness, welcoming God's awareness, calling on his eyes, his ears, to our deepest longings. The presence of God within us must move us beyond the automatic, the habitual. It must move us beyond second nature to first nature. It must become the central moment, the first responder, the love of our life. It brings life. It brings peace and comfort, a lamp to our feet. It transcends all of our fears. We are redeemed from man's oppression and lack of control. God's face will shine upon us, controlling our thought, our meditation. Life is settling, is letting God in, the ultimate control, not because of our righteous deeds, but because of his great mercy. And so we see here how this becomes an anchor of Daniel's life and persisting every day, three times a day. We have to persist in this. What about some brief thoughts about life-saving habits that we can employ? Well, numbering our days. They are numbered, so we should keep track of the numbers. And here's what Moses says, Psalm 90, verse 10 and 11, very well-known psalm. For all our days pass away under our wrath. Your wrath, sorry. This is important. For all our days pass away under your wrath. God. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. They're so briefly passing by. The years of our life are 70, or maybe by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are gone, and we fly away. And here's the point in this prayer. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? So do we live out our few years that we have under the understanding that we are wicked, we are sinners, and we need God's mercy. And without it, we will be subject to the wrath of God at the end of these few years that we have to live. Let's not forget the words of Moses. He reminds us that we all live our lives under the wrath of God. We exist because of God's mercy, not because of our own goodness. So Moses said, teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. What else does the Bible say about time? Well, here's some well-known verses. Job says, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and come to their end without hope. My days are swifter than a runner. They flee away. They see no good. They go by like skiffs of reed, like an eagle swooping on its prey. Psalm 39, David says, O Lord, make me know my end and what is the measure of my days. Let me know how fleeting I am. Behold, you have made my days a few handbreadths, and my lifetime is as nothing before you. Our life is short. We need to understand that. We're living out our lives under God's wrath and according to his mercy. Some words from Jesus about time. Stay awake at all times, he says. But watch yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and cares of this life. I remember Belshazzar there, just spending his time drinking wine. Cares of this life, and that day come upon you suddenly like a trap. Days are numbered. Tonight, this kingdom will be required of you, for it shall come upon all who dwell on the face of the earth. So we got to stay awake at all times, praying that we may have strength to escape all these things that are going to take place and to stand before the Son of Man. Jesus says, watch yourself. In another place, he says, examine yourself. One of the greatest challenges that we have, and I'm going to say it again for the third time, is an amazing lack of self-awareness. Just not being able to understand ourselves as others see us, as God sees us. And staying awake. That doesn't mean staying awake all night like King Darius, but being mentally awake, cognitively awake, with a sound mind, with the strength of truth and faith, standing before the Son of Man, both now and forever. And I can't, of course, get away from this haunting verse in Revelation that we all know about this beast, and the breath of this image of this beast that somehow comes alive, maybe by artificial intelligence, so it speaks and causes those who worship, who would not worship the image of the beast, to be slain in control. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand of the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark. That is the name of the beast, or the number of his name. This calls for wisdom. And I can't get over the creepy feeling I had earlier this week when I signed up for my number, my barcode with the provincial health department. How creepy does this get? How far does this go? Where does this stop? They can cancel us, especially considering our personal involvement with the system and the various platforms and devices that we seem to be enslaved in. They're all around us. They know everything that's going on around us. At what point do we say, no, I'm not going any farther? Well, we need this image here because we can't go to eat at our favorite restaurants without it, and so on. So what is the point at which we say, no, we're not going to be a barcode? Now, Jesus calls us to action. Now, there will be signs in the sun and the moon and the stars and the earth, the distress of nations with perplexity because of the roaring of the sea and the waves, people fainting for fear and foreboding what is coming on the earth. So there will be people whose knees are knocking together like Belshazzar's, for the powers of heaven will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now, when you see these things and they begin to take place, I suggest they are taking place all around us. Straighten up and raise your heads, because your redemption is drawing nigh. Another well-known phrase we can throw in here, the handwriting is on the wall. The world is coming to an end. Our days are numbered. The world is moving, if we understand it, I think, into one big concentration camp. I'm going to give you a number. However, don't forget this. They might want your number, but Jesus knows your name. And Jesus is the man. Paul said, when he's speaking to the Athenians, because God has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. He's given the world assurance of this by raising him from the dead. We can be sure of that, brothers and sisters and friends. We are God's offspring. That day has been appointed. The days have already been numbered for the great day that is coming. God has fixed that day, and that man is Jesus Christ. And finally, John, Jesus's cousin and beloved disciple, writes the book of Revelation, and these are some of his final words when he sees this vision, as he's carried away by the Spirit into a high mountain. And he sees the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down of heaven from God and having the glory of God, its radiance like a most rare jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had great high walls with 12 gates, and it had 12 angels, and on the gates the names of 12 tribes of Israel. And the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. In these two verses, he uses the word like three times. He was describing something that he had never seen before. The only thing he could do is say, this is like that. The only thing he could do is say, this is amazing. Something that John could not possibly clearly imagine. It was beyond amazing. That change is coming. That amazing moment is coming. The day is coming. And you just don't want to miss it.